Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with international law and human rights scholar, Dr. Kohav Elkayam Levy. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Detailed are pins in the comments below. And thanks to my mom, Lenny Meyerson, for being the founding sponsor of my show. Dr. Kohav Elkayam Levy has spent her career fighting for women's rights and gender equality. Then October 7th happened, and her sense of international social justice was completely upended. Kohav was imploring them to pay attention to the weaponization of sexual violence against women by Hamas and their horrifying methodology of terrorizing and brutalizing families and children in the most unfathomably evil ways, and the human rights world was silent. Along with former Canadian Justice Minister Erwin Kotler, Kohav coined a new classification of crimes against humanity, kinocide, the weaponization of familial bonds for strategic ends. Kohav has spent the last 16 months cataloging and archiving tens of thousands of videos, photos, and testimonials from that one-day Holocaust. Her work has been tireless and traumatic, and it's left her asking the emotionally excruciating questions. Do Israeli lives even matter? And are we even human? Today, Kohav and I will discuss her work, her nation, and the state of human rights in the world today. Trigger warning that some of what we discuss may be disturbing to hear. Dr. Kohav Elkayam Levy is the founder and chair of the Civil Commission on October 7th Crimes by Hamas Against Women and Children and the Devorah Institute for Gender and Sustainable Studies. Known for her impactful work in gender equality and human rights, she has spearheaded national and global efforts addressing the sexual abuse and gender-based atrocities of October 7th. An expert in international law and feminist theories, Dr. Elkayam Levy served as a Sophie Davis postdoctoral research fellow at Hebrew University, currently teaches at Reichman University, and serves as a senior fellow at the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. She received the 2024 Israel Prize in Solidarity, Israel's highest civilian honor, and was also honored with the Medal of Distinction by the Peres Center for Peace and Innovation. Thank you, Kohav. Thank you for the unbelievably difficult and important work you're doing. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me and for everything that you have been doing since October 7th. I feel it's amazing to get to know people like you and what we have become as a people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say that this podcast has been the greatest honor and in pleasure, can't really be the word, but of my life, to be able to speak to people like you who are literally changing the face of history. So I'd like to start this conversation by flashing back to October 7th, 2023. Mm-hmm. When you first got news about the terrorist attacks, I'm curious, how did you process or make sense of what you were hearing, and what were your first thoughts?
Wow, I was shocked. I was, I couldn't believe this is happening. I was actually with my father. He was hospitalized for different reasons at Sheba Hospital, and I was sitting there. It was kind of a surreal, like surrounded by elderly people that were themselves shocked to see what's going on, and the kind of people were begging to be saved. People were calling from the shelters, saying that they are being burnt alive, that their parents were murdered. It was, I often say in my, when I give lectures on October 7th, that I think the one big thing we've lost on October 7 is our sense of security in our country. Existential threat. I cannot explain it. I cannot. It's like a physical, even a physical feeling that your house and your country is being taken. And I think the trauma will last for generations to come. I hope we will regain our trust in our ability to live here, in safety.
Yeah, it sounds very similar, quite honestly, to how Americans felt after 9/11. And I know that the 9/11 parallels get tiresome. And there's nothing,
I agree.
there's such different things. But I can tell you, much like Israel, America had never been attacked on its own soil before. And I understand that feeling of vulnerability
Exactly.
where you where in the United States and in Israel as well have been so, impervious up until those two points.
I agree.
This is just a side note. You were in a hospital. This is a hospital that has been treating that I know treated victims, and also I believe have some of the hostages come to that same hospital.
I think so. I think some of them has been have been hospitalized in Sheba. At the beginning, it was Ichilov and then Belinson, several hospitals that received the hostages in a very welcoming environment set up specifically for them.
I was wondering if while you were at the hospital that day, did you see victims coming in? What was the scene at the hospital like?
It was Saturday morning, and when I was driving to the hospital, usually the roads are clear, and there was already traffic, and I had to take, because I know the hospital very well. My father was hospitalized for several months. I took a detour to a clearer path, but I couldn't understand why so early in the morning there is already traffic to the hospital. So that's the only thing that I saw. And I left there at midnight, scared of all the sirens. Scared that a siren will catch me or that someone will be on the road. It was,
So,
shocking. I think it was also shocking to receive all of the videos and the images. We couldn't believe our eyes. We couldn't believe that this is happening.
I mean, even in America, same. And but it's hard to imagine, and I'm going to get into this later, how you have actually had to relive this every minute of every day in your research, and I can't imagine the trauma that that has inflicted on you personally. But if possible, could we talk about that at the end, just to set up some context?
Yeah,
Okay,
of
so.
course. I think just I will say that today I feel a bit angry. Like reflecting on the past year and a half since October 7th, I feel angry that we had to take upon ourselves this mission of documenting these crimes, of exposing ourselves to those traumatic materials so early on. It's like we touched the fire without any gloves. And really, I don't think there are gloves that can protect you from witnessing this. There are only ways to mitigate the effect. But I feel even, I don't know, the anger of us needing to do this work and so early try to prove that this has happened. And the inability of really the softest mechanisms at the UN to give voice to the victims has made us take upon ourselves this mission of documenting the crimes, and sending us on this roller coaster since October 7th of sharing with the world what we are witnessing, what are we seeing, analyzing the materials, preserving them, feeling that we have to preserve everything for historical purposes and for legal purposes. I don't know, it feels unjust.
It feels unjust because it is unjust. And just to clarify for our listeners, so you've been documenting the atrocities of 10/7 in much the same way as Spielberg Shoah Foundation did with the Holocaust survivors. I believe you've had some coordination with them as well. It was almost 50 years after the Holocaust when he established that archive, and it took about that long, honestly, for bona fide Holocaust denial to really start propagating in academic circles. In stark contrast, October 7th denialism didn't take but 5 minutes to start spreading like wildfire across social media. And wherein the Shoah Foundation was in the business of documentation so we don't forget as a historical reference, yours was literally to fight the denialism as well. The denial, again, despite the fact that the archival footage was shot, proudly, I might add, by Hamas themselves. Yeah. So, Chav, I'm curious because it's such a unique dynamic of denialism in the face of absolute concrete evidence. How long after 10/7 did you know that this documentation project was a historical imperative? And when did the commission officially start?
It was mid-November that after we sent a lot of communications to many UN officials that we are calling for them to act swiftly for the return of the hostages, give voice to them that have been, women and children have been held so violently and taken, and men and elderly people. And we were shocked that they were unable to initially report October 7th. I want to mention a statement. It was the end of October, October 29th, that the International Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the most important women's rights international committee that exists at the UN, decided to release a statement not mentioning October 7th, not mentioning our hostages. And I was supposed to deliver a speech to that committee on October 30th, and I was shocked. I couldn't believe that they are unable to call for the return of the hostages, to mention that they exist, to mention the brutality of all of those that have been murdered. I'm not even talking about the sexual atrocities yet. I did talk about it during my speech, but I was shocked of their initial inability to report the crimes, to express solidarity, to call for the return of the hostages. It felt like they destroyed a very core belief that I had in the international system. You have to understand that this is what I teach my students, of the importance of the human rights system and the historical background of how these mechanisms were formed, and from the ashes of the Holocaust, from the ashes of World War II, and their failure is a failure of the weakest mechanisms that exist to protect human rights, right? All they do is give voice to the victims. And it was shocking. And I said then, and I still believe now, that their silence has fueled denial. And it was it fueled anti-Semitism, and especially the denial of the sexual atrocities. And several mechanisms continue to stay silent. Many people, I want to say that the UN is comprised of many entities, and so many of them have failed that it really frightens me to know that, the system, the international system, has failed so deeply to represent the victims. And I know we talk about a lot of international organizations that civil human rights organizations, but here those are the institutions who are supposed to protect us, to have all the information of atrocities around the world, and have been neglected, Israeli women, Jewish women, and it was this shock. And so it was then, after this speech, that I kind of said, we have to establish an archive. It was that was the beginning of October, of November, and then by mid-November we established a commission. We outlined the mission statement of documenting the crimes, researching them, not only documenting, but making sure we bear witness today to report to the world of what we see. And you're right, the fact that it was documented by Hamas, celebrated by the perpetrators, was shocking, that at the same times we saw denial. It's just, I can't get my head around it. Many people ask me, why do you think this has happened? So I don't think anyone has good answers to that, except that instead of anti-Semitism being mitigated after October 7, it became much more, how would you say, what's the word?
Explosive.
Exactly. Explosive and mean. Someone told me that viewing the materials and the documentation of Jews being humiliated, being murdered, and so viciously has sparked anti-Semitism, sparked these very deep notions of hate. And we saw, I don't know, Kanye West tweet. I was just shocked. I don't know if it's just to wake up this morning to see that.
I do actually, on one hand, sparked is a really good word. But on the other hand, I think it
already existed.
Yeah, exactly. That all it's done is brought it to the surface. There's no rational explanation, and nor can I think of a single parallel in history where the world turned against the victims rather than the perpetrators of one of the most horrific documented crime. I mean, I know there have been horrific crimes that have been similar around the world, but they weren't caught on video and broadcast to the world. It's incomprehensible. In a sign of absolute moral rot, there's no other possible word but the anti-Semitic element that has come from, that has, again, not come from, but surfaced from this, has been one of the most confounding things to behold, and certainly underlies all of this vast denialism, because to acknowledge the terror would be to acknowledge that the Jews are not the oppressors, and that is too painful for them to.
I don't know. I feel that what you said is exactly right. I delivered a lecture a year before October 7th on the rise of anti-Semitism around the world, and also of the hate crimes against the LGBTQ community around the world. And I made the connection between the regression in women's rights, the regression in the LGBT community rights, and anti-Semitism that is rising. And it was a year before October 7th. And people also tell me, why were you surprised? You're an expert in international law. You know how the UN is biased against Israel. Why were you surprised? And I think all of us were surprised, especially since we had this naive belief that they can separate political aspects from human rights aspects, from victims, that we have a part as women in the international community, and that they will be there for us, especially as women, especially as children. And the shocking reality that they weren't even able to report the crimes, not even able to call for the return of the hostages for so long, not even refer to the sexual atrocities. You know, UN Women released a statement on the year anniversary, and you need to read it to... I don't know, I felt my body, it was like You know how you feel your blood is heated? Like they use the 1 year anniversary of October 7th to release a statement, again, not mentioning the sexual atrocities and condemning Israel at the same time. So I was thinking it is on the bodies of these victims that were murdered so viciously. Couldn't you just express solidarity? Couldn't you just express deep concern of what has happened to them? I don't know. I feel I said it at the very beginning that after so many times, I don't have another explanation, but anti-Semitism and other aspects that have woven into paradigms of Israel. And of course, I think, as you said, Israel has been demonized for so many years. Perhaps we didn't realize how it is, how it caught up in circles that we thought we belonged to. And how it all turned against us.
Yeah.
Can I add something, Shane? I want to say, to be a bit more positive, that our strategy has been to look for our moral allies, to look for those who want to believe, to look for those who express moral clarity at this very difficult times, instead of fighting and saying they don't believe, they hate us, they are anti-Semites. So that's important. But we were like, okay, we need to find those who believe. And we have met with so many leaders around the world and experts and human rights and women's rights organizations who have very bravely stood by our side. And so that's important to remember too. And I after these meetings, I wish I had a immediate connection with the Israeli public to share with them. They believe this person, this leader, has done so much to stand by our side. I just want to mention, for instance, the French Minister of Gender Equality, that after our meeting and after the work of many that have contacted her about the sexual atrocities, she released a statement condemning the crimes and also made a resolution that the French government would not provide governmental funding to human rights and women's rights organizations who are denying October 7th. And she invited us to the UN and et cetera. Like, I can give more example, but we do have moral allies, and we do need to focus some of our energy on those who want to know more.
Absolutely. And I know that the Biden-Harris administration also stepped up immediately upon meeting with you. I think that we.
Exactly. They released a statement that was a historical statement. When the UN did not release any statement, the Biden administration released a historical statement condemning the crimes and acknowledging our work. And it made possible all the other connections that we had since. I think I returned to Israel after the visit at the White House to more than 1,600 requests from all around the world to meet with us, to hear what we know and what we don't know yet, what we can share with the world about what happened. And it was truly meaningful. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think that it's a sad part of our discourse that the word that everyone keeps using over and over for our allies is brave. And I don't think there's anything brave about it. I think that anybody with an ounce of moral clarity, I think there should be shame for anybody who does not understand the gravity of what occurred or acknowledge the atrocities. But I think that there's nothing brave about this. The only thing that's brave is the fact that the viciousness of the attacks that come back at us, I spend half my day deleting messages from my social media. I literally had somebody just today who went through all my messages about the released hostages and put laughing emojis, which, by the way, you can't delete. Just dozens of them, laughing emoji, laughing emoji, laughing emoji. And in the emboldening of this vicious anti-Semitism, people doing and saying things that are so beyond the realms of human decency. So before we go on, so you got 1,600 requests. I'm wondering what came of that, because I didn't hear about them in the media or social media. And silence is complicity. We need not just allies, but allies who are standing up and speaking up for us. Out of 1,600, what would you say came of that?
Oh, wow. First of all, of analysis that has been made in May of my interviews around the world and engagements with international experts and international and global leaders, there have been more than 8 billion views of only written media interviews and of information that we shared, 8 billion views. And that's not including the not written media, like the digital media, mm-hmm. interviews to BBC and other CNN and other outlets. And I think together with others that have raised their voice in that moment, we were able to establish recognition outside the UN. And many countries that we went from country to country to establish recognition and get them to give us statements. And those statements have legal importance. And not only that, it pushed the UN to send the Pramila Patel, the special UN rapporteur on sexual violence during conflict. I can speak about her report and its importance because it was important. It exposed the brutality. You can access the special UN rapporteur on sexual violence in conflict areas, Pramila Patel. You can look for her report. I also recommend seeing Sheryl Sandberg's film, Screams Before Silence. I think it's an amazing way to, and a very sensitive and intelligent way to share information about the sexual atrocities. And it has been distributed among so many leaders around the world and the general public. I want to say something about the bravery that you mentioned I'll say two things. One about the bravery. Those who spoke up have paid a price. So that's why I personally call them brave. You know, we met when Cheryl and I visited France, and we met an expert there that shared with us that for so many years, she's fighting for victims of sexual violence all around the world. And October 7th was the only instance when she was so viciously attacked by her own community, by the feminist community in France, by her own colleagues that have told her not to express her views. And she decided nevertheless to be somehow isolated in some ways, but to raise her voice against this. She said that it made her even more determined to act, but we cannot take it for granted. I meet so many that are afraid of the personal price they will pay, cost they will pay for standing with us. So that's about the bravery of right. those who want to stand by our side and the prices they are paying. And I want to say about the sexual atrocities. So we've gained a lot of recognition, but I said recently that the denial is just becoming far more intelligent and far more complex and to fight. At the beginning, it was social trolls that were attacking us, like you just mentioned, those who are cursing, sending threats, sharing very scary posts against us and against this work. But at the moment, I'm seeing experts who are participating in denial, conferences, academic conferences. For instance, just recently, people shared with me an academic conference where you have feminist scholars that are putting a question mark on whether sexual atrocities have been committed on October 7th. So we're seeing a far more intelligent denial and far more dangerous, which makes us even more determined to document everything to preserve the historical truth of what happened. And it's even more painful to see feminist scholars participating in this. They know how easy it is to un victims of sexual abuse. Even in individual cases, you don't have to be very sophisticated to deny what a victim of sexual abuse is saying. So to see them participating in this discourse is just painful, and lack of other word to describe it. And so yes, that's a huge challenge.
The intersectional hypocrisies that have emerged after 10/7 go beyond all reason, logic, and explanation. Again, like everybody, anybody who doesn't know by now what Hamas would do to the LGBTQ community, and yet they choose to stand with terror instead of Jews, says everything that we need to know about that. Your focus in your studies in general are about crimes against women and children. And I just want to say on a personal note that though women and children represent the most vulnerable segment of society and a protected segment of society, every single life matters and matters equally. And so I do want to just take a moment to recognize on the most heartfelt and profound level the suffering of men as well. I can't imagine like my own son or brother or father or grandfather being subjected to any of the litany of war crimes being committed by Hamas on and since 10/7. The deeply tormenting images of Eli Sharabi, Or Levy, and Ohad Ben Ami's release this past weekend drove that point home on the in the most heartbreaking fashion. I'm curious, your commission has been focused on the crimes of October 7th. Are you also documenting the hostages, or will you be? I'm sure at this point it's a little too sensitive to tell. Oh, of course, there were the hostages that came out in November 2023. Are you also documenting their experiences in Hamas captivity?
Yes, I want to say something. I completely agree with what you said. The reason, the fact that we are documenting crimes against women and children is not in any way to diminish from the horrible, brutal crimes that have been committed against men. It's just a focal point of focusing on those protected communities under international law, and especially what transpired in the sexual atrocities. And I do want to say that unfortunately, we also documented sexual abuse against men as well on October 7th and in captivity. So that's really important to say. And yeah, there is no hierarchy here or any. Yeah, I agree with you. I want to say that. Seeing the returned hostages this week has been so depressing, so difficult. I know I was thinking of all for so many months now, his wife that was murdered so viciously, and also Ellie, that his wife and daughters have been murdered, and we have documented that since the beginning. I can't share much. I want to share, but I will not share much. I will just say that each of the hostages that come back, we have the images in our heads of what they have been through, the videos of them taken into captivity, the knowledge of what they have suffered. I'll just give, for instance, Yarden, the video of him that Hamas released telling him that his wife and children have been murdered, have been killed, when we didn't have any, we still don't have reliable information on that. But to see how they were torturing him by giving him the information and putting a video camera to his face to make sure they document his suffering and broadcast it to the world has been devastating for many months. And to know that he was returning to this reality and what they've been through, I can't even, yeah, there are no words. And I want to say something important. You mentioned it in the beginning. Through our documentation of what happened to women and children, we unfortunately revealed the torture and systematic abuse of families. I will not get into all the details of that. I will just say that we found another video and another video of the Hamas entering the houses, murdering family members in front of each other. We felt like we cannot physically bear witness to it. Like we had to leave the room. I had to like stop it. I can't, please pause. And we saw so many violent and disturbing materials, but the ones on those videos that documenting the atrocities committed against families are, for me personally, are the worst. To see the children crying, the terrified eyes of the families, of the parents, to know that they just witnessed the murder of one of their family members. And not only the videos, the testimonies of those families that we started collect, like you said, like the Shoah Foundation, we started collecting the testimonies like Yad Vashem, and to hear the stories of what they went through is heartbreaking. And when we understood that we are seeing, we're not seeing a random attack, but we're seeing similar patterns repeating in different location. It was when I contacted international scholars and asked them, "Have you heard of this? Where can I read of this crime of the weaponization of families, of abusing, systematically abusing families during conflict?" And when we understood that it's a crime without a name, and that we don't have enough information of documenting these atrocities from the lens of the abuse of families, this is when we decided to first coin it as kinocide. As you said, kin as in familial relation, and side as in the systematicity and abuse of familial bonds to intensify the suffering. And we released a report that you'll probably be sharing with your with the audience here. And I think what's most disturbing for us and what we are sharing with global leaders around the world is the fact that the videos that are showing the abuse of families are an inspiration to terror all around the world. Because when you see the unique suffering it creates to kill family members, to kill family members in front of one another, you understand, and how they celebrated it, you understand how it can be inspire similar crimes around the world. So
It's also that, so often we call what happened on October 7th a massacre, but the truth is, it wasn't just a massacre. It was a system of methodical torture to
exactly.
go and even again, like coming back to this last weekend and how they went so far out of their way to humiliate them and make them cheer in a dungeon and tell them they're excited to see their families who they did not know were already murdered. And the fact that they do it on Shabbat, that the only way that we can partake is by breaking the Sabbath, and also to bring the joy of the Sabbath out. And just the fact that they decided to kidnap certain people instead of murder them. It goes so far beyond massacre. The fact that they thought it was appropriate to torture people and stab them and dismember them before they killed them. And I need to calm down.
It was a strategy. It was a strategy. It wasn't a random attack. We found six patterns, repeating patterns of abuse. As I said, repeating in different locations, of separating family members, of murdering them in front, using the social media, not only of Hamas, but of the victims themselves. I think tell you a story about that. But first I'll say that they took the phones of the victims and made sure the first ones to witness what happened, what is happening, is the family members. And I can tell you, the wider circles of the relatives and family members that had to witness this terror live streamed by Hamas has extended the trauma and the suffering in much greater scales that we have known. And I can tell you that we've been contacted by the Ministry of Justice, the legal aid department that is aiding families and representing them in courts, said that they are using our report, first thanking us for giving it a name. They have been working with the families to represent what they have been through for many months, and suddenly when they saw our report, they were like, it made sense to them that this was a unique attack, that this is a unique suffering. And then they use it to make sure those families receive a compensation from the Israeli government under the special funds that are available for victims of terror in Israel. And they try to make sure they will receive some kind of reparations to what they have been through. So this is the little justice that we are now seeing happening.
Yeah, and as of today, we still have 76 hostages in Hamas captivity after more than 16 months. It's utterly unimaginable. And I just to point out just how brutal, because you mentioned Yarden, and obviously one of the most famous of the hostages. I shouldn't even say that. So many people didn't even know about Yarden. They just knew about Shiri and Ariel and Kfir. But to reiterate just how systemic this torture is, I mean, Kfir was 9 months old, maybe just under 9 months old when he was kidnapped. His brother, Ariel, was four. Shiri and Yarden were separated deliberately by the kidnappers. And ironically, we find out now that Yarden thought that by going with them, he would save his family, which is a whole nother level of heartbreak. In the photo of Shiri clutching her babies to her breast, terrified as the terrorists pulled them from their home, is permanently branded in all of our minds. And people might also not know that Shiri's parents, Jose and Margit, were also murdered in cold blood. And the terrorists even took the extra step of slaughtering the family dog. The vicious psychological violence that you mentioned about live streaming, or I don't know if it was live streaming, I saw it, the videos of showing Yarden squirm in agony, as they tell him his wife and children were murdered. And we don't know, again, as you said, there's no evidence, and we're all praying by some miracle that they're still alive. But this is just one of like hundreds of examples of genocide, not just the massacre of families, but the deliberate, relentless, and excruciating torture of them as well. You said that there are six distinct patterns. You started saying some of them. Can you lay out the six patterns and how they were used by Hamas's tools of terror?
Yes. So, murder of family members in front of one another, killing of entire family units, We know, for instance, the Kutz family that was found, that were found, the five members, the two parents and their three children were found hugging each other, and all of them were killed. So that's the second pattern. The third one is separating family members from one another. The fourth one is taking families hostage, taking families and children hostage. The fifth one is the use of social media, and is also the social media of the victims themselves. And the sixth one is the vandalisms of family homes, the burning of family homes when families were still hiding inside. When we visited the kibbutzim, we did site visits for many hours to study what happened in each of them. We found similar testimonies of people sharing how many hours they spent in destroying the houses. And I want to give an example also to, you know, you sometimes think, wow, they wasted a lot of time doing this, creating destruction, making sure we have these strong memories in our heads. As you said, for generations to come, we're going to have this memory of Shiri clutching her babies. And they did, we're going to have far more images in our head and our grandchildren, etc. And the fact that they spent so long in creating the destruction, in creating the separation, and not randomly just kill everyone, just making sure they kill one member or two members, and then continue taking the rest to captivity, or making sure some just witness the murders and stay alive to tell what they saw. It's just, it wasn't one terrorist group that was had this inspiration of doing that. It repeated in different location, what indicates the organized fashion of this attack, the fact that it was a strategy. And I was saying about the fact that they spent so many hours in each house to create destructions and burn the house. I have in my head the quote of Rote Matthias from the report, that he shared that they entered the shelter, they found him and his parents, they killed his parents, they injured him. He was hiding under the body of his mom. Because of the podcast, I don't want to share much, but I'll just say that he said, and then mom died on top of me. That's the quote in the report. And he shared that he had to lay under her body for quite some time. And then he said they returned to burn the house. So some of the families were burned entirely. So we want to know what happened. When they returned to destroy and burn the house, he managed to escape. And we have him as a survivor that survived for some miracle, miracle reason, to tell us what happened. But it's just the fact that this was done to create the most deep trauma and collective trauma, and for us as a people, as a nation, in a way that we will need to find ways to overcome.
Absolutely. Why was it important to give Kinocide a name?
I think that's the most important part of it for me, giving it a name. We debated whether we should give it a name. Perhaps it should be for other legal scholars to debate what should be the best name for it. It was like it was an entire process. But for me, it was clear that we are seeing a phenomena that was never seen as such. And it was clear to me that we are seeing a deliberate targeting of families. And what became even clearer was what it meant for the victims to hear that we acknowledge what happened to them, that we are giving a language to their suffering. We've met from victims of the Yazidi community, And we shared with them our work, and they said, "It happened to us. Please mention that it happened to us. They killed our families in front of our eyes." And we have Professor David Craney, who was the head of the Sierra Leone, the special tribunal that was established in Sierra Leone. When he saw our report, he immediately said, "Please mention that it happened in Sierra Leone." And to see the eyes of those victims, of the families, that we share with them this work, and we said, this is what we think it is called. This is how it happened all over the world, and this is how we should refer to it. First of all, I feel like it gives them some kind of conceptualization or understanding or recognition of what they have suffered. And for us, it's the beginning of confronting this, creating prosecution, protection, prevention. I just feel like, as a legal scholar, justice is so slow. Legal processes are sometimes feel like it will never happen. And for me, just for the fact that this is providing some kind of language to the victims, it means the world. I just, for me, it's just that. I can't even talk yet of accountability, of all the processes that it starts. But I can tell you what's interesting is that people are starting to use it all around the world,
Yeah.
and to bring light to things that have happened that have never been seen as such.
And what about the legal implications? I mean, is there the possibility of future and more specifically retroactive international jurisdiction when the term is finally universally recognized and adopted?
Yes, definitely. We are now publishing a few, the future publications will show, and already the report is showing how existing international law and domestic courts can already refer to this crime, how they can incorporate it, how they can provide reparations for the victims. And as I said, we were just approached by the legal aid of the Ministry of Justice that they have used the report to prove that the families have endured a specific harm that they should be recognized as direct victims of the terror attack. So I'm hoping that with and without us, courts will use it, legal scholars would use it, and others, experts around the world who are studying these atrocities and trying to make sense and what should happen, how we can prevent it. It already happens.
I'm thinking more in terms of something like a Nuremberg trial,
Yeah.
whether it's 5 years down the road, 1 year down the road, or 20 years down the road. Like, if the institutionalization of a concept into human rights law would give that kind of possibility.
The question of the prosecution of the terrorists and how this is going to look like, it really something that I'm investing a lot of thought in, especially as you said, that there is importance of bringing these stories to the world to hear in a special kind of tribunal that would be able to bring justice to the victims and make sure not only the terrorists are prosecuted, but the stories of the victims are heard. So that's something that I'm really putting a lot of thought recently. I'm happy to talk to you about it in a few months. Especially in the sexual atrocities, it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a challenge to bring it to court, and we want to show that it's possible and it happened around the world, and that those victims who don't have any voice, most of them have been murdered, should be heard and should be recognized, and what happened to them, should be known to the world.
Yeah, and at the same time, that it's so imperative that the terrorist crimes committed on 10/7 and since are documented for the historical record, there are also tremendous sensitivity considerations to take into account while doing so. Like, I'm curious, like, how do you balance the issues of privacy and sensitivity with the need to gather as much specific evidence and information as possible?
Exactly. It's so difficult. You know, I said mid-November, you asked me where it all started. I said, we need to establish an archive under the most compelling international standards. Had I known what it means, what it entails, how difficult it would be, how traumatizing it would be, I'm not sure I would have taken it upon myself. So these dilemmas of privacy, of ethics, of how to do this properly are dilemmas that have been with us since the very beginning. We have established a secured system, thank God, to Israeli high tech and to tech companies like Microsoft that have provided us with the means to store the information in a secured system. The head of the archive is the former deputy head of the Yad Vashem archive, who is phenomenal. Her name is Eleanor Cortero, has developed the archive in a way that adheres to the most, as I said, compelling international standards. And it's still in process. The archive is, we're establishing it now. And also we've developed an ethical code based on the Murad code. The Murad code is the code that was developed by Nadia Murad. She is the Nobel Prize winner that has shared the sexual atrocities of the Yazidi community and developed a whole moral code and ethical code of how to take testimonies from victims. So we have implemented it. We've created an ethical code for the commission. And I think since the very beginning, we've had so much pressure of sharing the information, sharing photos, and we always say that it's not ours to share, first of all. Some of the families don't know what have happened to their loved ones. And as you said, there are many privacy aspects and legal aspects to make sure those who see it are those that need to see it.
And I actually do want to get into that, but I'm actually taking a step back from that and actually collecting it. Like, how, so you have to be very, very sensitive in how you approach the victims, but at the same time, you need the information. Do you feel like you can get the whole story, or maybe over time it will unfold as they're ready? Do they come back months later and say, I'm ready to tell you this thing? Like, what has the information gathering process been like?
Oh, excellent.
Firsthand, I mean, not the video account.
So I'll just say, at the beginning, it was people that shared with us videos and photos and images. And for instance, journalists that have been there and took photos and videos, and first responders. And of course, as I said, the documentation of Hamas itself, that we made sure we collect very early. And about the testimonies, it's very, very sensitive. As you said, it takes time to come forward. I'll share a story, okay, of a woman from one of the kibbutzim that reached out to me after one of the conferences. She heard me speak, and then she reached out to me crying. And I need to, her, she's a very strong old woman, like from the kibbutzim. They're very, I don't know. Yes, and to see her break and crying, and she told me, I have information that I want to share with you, but I'm scared. I want it to be concealed for 50 years. Will you conceal it for 50 years? And I'm not sure that the grandchildren deserve to know it. And my brother tells me that I shouldn't share it. So it's this kind of conversations with eyewitnesses, with survivors, with people who have information about the identification of the victims. that we are working with very, very gently, very sensitively on their attention. I think one of the most important things that I have learned after October 7th is how important this process of giving them control of what they're sharing, getting their consent, and making sure this consent stays. Like if we want to make use, for instance, for the report, everything we shared in the report is known and was published in the media. And we debated whether we should contact the families and share it with them, the kind of information that we collected. And we decided to do it, even though it was published everywhere, like, no, we will make sure we send them the information. And so we sent every expert of the report to each of the families to make sure they feel comfortable with how we described it. So they thanked us, and the process of them owning their own stories, I think that's the most important part of holding such an archive, of collecting these testimonies and making sure, as I said, they gain control of what happened to them. One of the most difficult things that we are seeing now is the agony of the families of how their loved one are going to be remembered. And Shani Luk, for example, everyone has the image of her body taken into Gaza, and you see the family now. It's another form of torture that the video is now a public domain, and the way that, it creates another form of victimization, and so we make sure we do this in a way that at least give them some sense of owning their stories.
Sure, you've gone to tremendous lengths to preserve their dignity, and you really practice extraordinary self-censorship and moderation in the evidence that you've presented to the general public. I'll say that Scream Before Silence did the same thing. It's I hate to say it, it's a very gentle portrayal of a very brutal reality, but at the same time, the vast and vocal anti-Israel elements do exactly the opposite in order to win over world sympathy. They not only exploit the most dramatic war footage possible, but even create elaborate Hollywood productions to fake atrocities, and it works really well. They cynically leverage their propaganda to convince a significant portion of the world population that the terrorists are the good guys, the victims, and Israel are the bad guys, the oppressors. So we have this vast denial of Hamas brutality on one hand, and overwhelming sympathy for the Gazans on the other hand, which presents this double-edged sword that has quite honestly slayed Israel's standing on the world stage. Is there a way for either your commission or the State of Israel that has the 49-minute movie that we've all heard about and thank God have not been subjected to present your most compelling evidence of genocide and of violence while still protecting the victims who endured this harrowing trauma? Because you're right, we should not have to fight this battle, but we do.
This is what we're doing since October 7th, making sure the stories are heard, the truth is heard, in the most compelling way possible. And I think it's often frustrating to see the propaganda and the hate and how Hamas is using the victims and everything to portray really a demonizing aspects of what we've been experiencing. And I'll say that I'll quote Professor Kotler, who quotes Martin Luther King. Whenever we feel like injustice is becoming so overwhelming, I have this sentence that he told me that Professor that Martin Luther King said that the arc of history bends toward truth and or towards justice. And at the end of the day, truth will prevail. And this is the reason why we're doing what we're doing, to make sure truth prevails. And we all have only a small part in this larger battle. You know, we cannot fight everything. We cannot take upon ourselves as if we can fight all this hatred, all this anti-Semitism. But we can only do our little part in history. So what you are doing, what we are doing, what each of us is taking upon ourselves after October 7th to do, I think together it brings greater light to the world. And I'm not saying this is a cliche. I truly believe it. We've all changed. I've never imagined doing this work. You know, I'm the most, people tell me you're so brave, but I'm really the opposite. I'm really the opposite of that. My mom always says that I was afraid to walk up the stairs to the second floor of the house because of it is dark, and I now see it on my little ones how they are just like me. So we didn't choose this, but we will continue fighting, even though it seems hard and even though it seems like it's impossible to get the truth out. It will happen, so we can only continue doing that. I don't know if it makes sense. This is how I make myself continue what we do, because it's so hard. And I have to say, to share something, you know, I felt it when I visited you in LA, all of you, the community in LA. Sometimes when we're here in Israel, we very easily forget why we're doing that, because everybody here believes. Everybody here are grieving, and they're telling us, so the world doesn't believe, the UN will never believe, no one will believe. So, meeting people from outside of Israel actually reminds us why we're doing that, why the documentation is important, why the historical record is something we need to fight for, because you're fighting denial that it's unimaginable. That it's hard for us in Israel to understand, because everybody are here grieving together, and no one is questioning what happens and what happened. But when you step outside of Israel, you understand the scale of the denial, of the hatred, of the anti-Semitism, and it's scary. And it gives us another perspective of what we're doing is important.
It's been an hour. I have a few more questions, but I know you also have a life. So it's up to you if you would like to wrap this up or continue to talk a bit about the UN and some other issues.
I think it will be great if we can wrap up,
Okay.
and I'm happy to share perhaps one more question, and then I think my children are gonna burst in any
Oh.
moment.
Okay. I like to end on a high note, but I also want to acknowledge how traumatic this process has been for you and the other members of your team. How have you been like balancing the clinical nature of your work with the emotionally brutalizing aspect of what you're forced to witness? And how have you personally protected yourself psychologically and emotionally these past 16 months?
Excellent question. So I'll start with the most with the how we cope with it as a commission. So I have to give the credit to the team. First of all, the leader of the commission, CEO Merav Israeli Amarant, is amazing. She created an emotional support system for the team together with with Nirit. Samocha, they created an emotional support system. We've created methodologies of coping with this. For instance, we try to document in the mornings and not in the evenings, like to create a buffer, and we are reviewing the materials and returning home. We try to do it in teams. I'm saying try, difficult to, you have to check effect. I can't make sure all the time someone is next to me. I need to check something, so I need to do it now. But generally, when we access the materials, we try to do it in teams and not alone, especially not alone in our houses. And as I said, we're trying to create buffers and provide emotional support to each member of the commission. I want to mention Irit Gazit. She's our the head of the documentation unit. She works with the victims. She collects the testimonies. She endures so much from not only collecting the testimonies, but staying in touch with the people so they feel like we don't know, we didn't just take something from them, but it's their story and we are preserving it for them. It's a delicate nuance, but it's so important. And I want to give her all the credit for the ethical code she developed for the commission. And so that has been, I'm surrounded by amazing women and men, and we are sharing this experience of documenting. And in this shared experience, there is some kind of comfort. The fact that we are doing it together, we have our own jokes, like black jokes on everything, like kinocide and coffee. I don't know. Anyway, we have our own humor. So it helps. I think it's the first time I'm sharing that. Personally, it's very difficult. I can say that people ask me, how am I doing it when I'm a mother to young children? And I'm saying exactly the opposite. I think I'm doing it and I'm managing to keep leading this mission because I'm a mother of four children. Because the time with the children is healing. Like you can imagine my baby, he was almost two when October 7th happened, and now he's three. And it's kind of the times, you see a baby and everything softens, and being with them, it's just I don't know, it makes me understand the importance of what we're doing. It's still difficult. There is no magic solution to the traumatizing effect. The fact that we're meeting with, I have my therapy every Friday. But I'm saying it just helps us handle it. It's not the, it is what it is. We didn't choose this, and we just keep going until I'm hoping that we wouldn't lose our strength doing that. So.
Now, I know you hate this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and it's in the show notes. How can people help and support your critical work? Please don't be shy.
I don't hate this question. It's just difficult for me to. I always feel like you can ask me anything but
Well,
that. So yeah,
exactly.
you share our work, follow us on social media. I feel like I have these amazing men and women who are following our work since October 7th, sending hearts, retweeting. It just, I don't know, it means the world to get these messages, small notes. We're with you. We see what you're doing. We have you have a way to support and donate to the commission. I think each of us has a different role. So some of you can bring screams of silence to those to your community. Some of you can share the report with experts, academic experts, or with journalists, or whatever you have in your capacity to do. We're here and we love your support. Webinars like this, conversations like this are important to us. I know it's hard to coordinate, but we made it, right?
We at long last, it took
I'm so
2 months,
sorry.
3 months.
But it means the world that you didn't give
Yeah.
up, and we did. We're doing it, and we did it. And
Okay.
you insisted on giving us a voice, and so I truly, truly appreciate it.
Yes. So I just want to stack on that I know it's very hard to I know all of these in-kind supports mean a lot, but if people have the money, I am personally going to make the plea. The information's in the show notes that you donate to the Devorah Project, to the Civil Commission, to help them to continue to give voice to the voiceless. Kochav, yeah. I don't really know how to thank you, not just for showing up, but for the dignity that you have given, not just to the 1,200 people who were massacred, not just to the 252 hostages and the ones that are still in captivity, not just for the more than 800 IDF soldiers that have been killed, but also to the family and the friends and those who have been permanently disabled and scarred for life with the post-traumatic stress. You say you're not brave. You're an absolute hero. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Shana. Thank you.